Ira Gitlin. Been on this program before. Ira is a multi-instrumentalist in the bluegrass world and an educator at a very high level. He gets what it takes to expose someone to the bluegrass world and get them interested in playing. And we decided this year at Gray Fox that we would talk about this issue. He has some very specific ideas about it. Most enjoyable visit with my friend Ira Gitlin. You're going to enjoy this conversation. Really an interesting, quite a bright guy. He has some very specific ideas about music and instructing it.
Really happy to welcome back to Unreal Bluegrass my friend Ira Gitlin. How are you, Ira?
I'm doing fine. Thanks
good.
So much, Steve.
Good. We're sitting at the Gray Fox Bluegrass Festival off to the side in the shade at a wonderful event. And Ira and I thought about an idea, mostly he did. Just a thing to catch up. Ira's been a guest before, talked about many things. Ira is a wonderful musician, banjo player, guitar player, teacher. Has always been teaching. Has always been forefront in what he does, is instructing and telling people about banjos. Most recently, I saw you down the hill doing a banjo, kind of like a beginning banjo class.
Oh, that one 2 days ago, yeah.
2 days ago, yeah. So you do that here. You have more teaching. I think you have another teaching opportunity with the Academy, the Kids Academy.
Well, the Kids Academy is my main thing here. I'm the banjo teacher on staff for that.
Okay.
You know, and that's meeting every day for the whole weekend throughout.
Well, and when I saw you here, I thought I hadn't talked to you in a while, and we should probably talk about some things that maybe tie into not just your skill as a player. We can talk about that and the music that you've done, but maybe a little bit into this. How do you handle the topic of bluegrass? It's a huge topic to talk about, but you're going to talk about getting bluegrass and maybe banjo and to new people. How do you get them into it?
Well, that's really an interesting thing at a festival like this. You know, there's always people who this might be the first bluegrass festival they've come to. They might have, for some people, it might even be the first bluegrass they hear. They might have friends who say, hey, come with us to this festival, and they've never really seen this stuff before. And I'm always aware of that in any situation I'm in where people are presenting music or talking about it, that there might be somebody there who just really is a total newcomer. I remember when I first started reading Bluegrass Unlimited, there was an ad for Stelling Banjos, and it was talking about a particular model of banjo that they had out. And it said something like, and Little Roy himself named it the, I forget what the model name was, but it doesn't matter. But I had no idea who this Little Roy guy was, but being a savvy reader, I said, this is somebody that whoever wrote this copy expects me to know about.
Yeah.
And I always think whenever I'm talking about music to a bunch of people about bluegrass, that there's somebody in that listening who might have that same level of ignorance that I had, you know, back then. That, and when musicians talk, they always, you know, there's stuff that they just assume because they, you know, they live and breathe this stuff. Like 2 years ago, we did a tribute to Bill Keith, the great banjo player,
right,
and innovator who had just passed
which
away.
Which I saw, and it was wonderful.
Yeah, he had just passed away a few months earlier, and it was, I forget who all, some guys who, you know, good, great players.
Oh, Ryan Cavanaugh.
Ryan Cavanaugh,
Mark Cody.
Mark Horowitz.
And Ron Cody was there. Right?
Yeah. And, you know, and you get a bunch of banjo players talking, and they're going to say things that, you know, just like they're talking among friends who all know the same stuff. And it dawned on me, we had, I don't know, what, 40, 50 people out there listening, and I felt it was kind of my job to make sure that everybody knew what we were talking about. Like somebody made some mention about, was that before or after he invented the pegs? And, you know, all banjo players
we
know.
We would know.
Right. It's referring to Keith peg, which is a way, it's a special mechanism in the tuning peg where you can preset how high or how low it will go, and you just turn it until it stops, and it'll go to that preset note.
Mm-hmm.
And Earl Scruggs had originally invented a mechanism for that, but Bill designed a completely different mechanism that's very widely used among banjo players. But it dawned on me, hey, I bet there's people out there who don't know what that is. So, you know, I stopped and said, wait a minute, guys, and how many of you all know what we're talking about? And, you know, or don't know what we're talking about? And, you know, like about 10 people's hands went up.
Right.
So I'm always trying to...
And they could have gone there because they're fans of Bill Keith. And still maybe not been accurately or acutely aware of the fact that this is something that's what the term meant.
Right. Or, you know, or who knows? Who knows why they were there?
Right.
I
could have been you.
Or they just, you know, they just wanted to sit in the shade for an hour instead of being out in the sun, you know. But so when I write about bluegrass, or when I'm teaching also, I'm always trying to figure out what are the things that a musician takes for granted that the student wants. And there's different. I teach a lot of beginners. Most of my private students come to me as beginners, but there's different kinds of beginners. And
I assume some come to you with some music knowledge from another instrument, but don't have any banjo knowledge. Some come to you with nothing.
Exactly. Yeah. And even the ones who have music knowledge, there's different levels. There might be people who have a fair bit of experience but never played a stringed instrument.
Right.
So, you know, if you play the guitar, let's say, then, hey, all I have to do is show them banjo. And there's some things about banjo that really takes them figuring. But, you know, it makes my job easier. If they play piano or clarinet or whatever, they have to learn the principles by which a string instrument is laid out. It's a two-dimensional grid where, you know, you have to specify which string and which fret, as opposed to, like, the piano where, you know, there's just one place to get that note. And that's something that you have takes a while to internalize, how to get around from one note to another on that grid. And then, like you said, there's the person who just has no experience at all. And my job in that situation, more than to show them what to do, is to teach them how to understand what music is about. Because, you know, it's a whole field with its own internal logic, concepts of pitch and rhythm that we take for granted. But
let's say someone comes to you and wants to be a banjo player. Mm-hmm. They have no knowledge of banjos or music. How do you blend in the basic concepts of music, you know, the scale or whatever we're going to play in, and the banjo? Do you devote time to getting... You can't possibly teach them all of music and then 2 years, 3 years later say,
no,
and this is a banjo.
No, of course not.
So how do you think about blending them?
Yeah, you have to have a combination of sort of the principles, the theory, and hands-on stuff. Because theory is not going to... It's not going to sink in if you don't actually do something with it. I mean, it would be like, you know, studying a five-dimensional geometry. You know, you could study it, mathematicians do, but it doesn't mean anything to you, right? You don't experience it in the world, so it's just this abstract thing.
It's so rare that you have five dimensions around you.
Yeah.
It's kind of
You know, so you start by showing them, you know, basic principles of rhythm. I'll show them, you know, Hey, how you doing? I'll show them. By the way, that's what I love about the festival environment.
That was like Kelly.
Yeah,
who everybody knows and loves, and people walk by and they say hello to everyone.
And some of these are people that I might only see once a year, or you know, twice a year here in some other festival. But anyway, so I'll show them two chords to start, and one of them, you know, as banjo players know, if you're in the most common way to tune the banjo for bluegrass, is a chord. So you get one chord for free just by being in tune. And then I show them another chord that you can play just by putting down two fingers. And in the course of that, I'm showing them principles of, you know, how you get a higher note, how you put your finger down to get a good sound. So even just in that little two-fingered chord, there's, you know, there's a bit of string instrument knowledge that they're getting from that. And then we'll just strum in rhythm while I sing. So they're just focusing on changing the chord at the right time. And
because you have to teach timing.
You have to teach timing. A lot of people, you know, have decent sense of timing if you can tap your foot to music, and most people can. You know, you got the basics there. But also the idea that you have to change chords at the right time, because if you're not playing the right chord, it doesn't sound right with the melody. And there are certain melodies that really make that clear. You can use and say, see, when I got that note, if I stayed on the G chord while I sang that note, it just doesn't sound right. So, you know, they're listening to the bigger picture of music, you know, melody, harmony, rhythm, all that kind of stuff. And then you can get more elaborate, more chords, and that's just not doing any of the stuff we think of as the sound of the banjo. It's just strumming. But then once they've got that down, then you can show them simple right hand patterns and say, okay, so instead of one strum, you do one repetition of this pattern, and I'll play them recordings of bluegrass and say, listen to what the other instruments are doing. Listen to how that right-hand pattern, how the speed of the notes that you're playing now fits in with what the guitar is doing, what the bass is doing. So it's incrementally, bit by bit.
Is it important, and it would depend on the student, if it's an individual student and not a class, mm-hmm. is it important that they be able to come back shortly, being able to, either whether it's a forward roll, which you and I would all understand, mm-hmm. something they can do and make a sound on the banjo?
Oh, yeah, you gotta give them, you know, give them little positive reinforcing things. And, you know, for some people, just changing chords and strumming along is like, you know, the light bulb goes off.
That's a miracle.
And, yeah, and then for others, like, you know, it might be the second or third lesson you get to actually picking those right-hand rolls. Rolls is the, you know, the term that banjo players use for the right-hand patterns, where it's like, oh, wow, now that's what it really sounds like. And I think of, I interviewed Mike Munford, great banjo player, plays with Frank Sullivan in Dirty Kitchen. Interviewed him for Banjo Newsletter a few years ago, and he was talking about when he was a teenager and just starting out, he had learned this one lick, this one little, you know, a four-note right-hand pattern with a slide on the third string, you know, like you used in Cripple Creek.
Right.
Yeah. And that was the only real banjo thing that he knew at the time. It was the first lick he had learned. And he said he would play it over and over for 2 hours on end because he just loved how it sounded.
It's pretty cool. You get the slide in there. You get the... It's got a lot
I remember
of exciting
that,
parts to it.
That lead-in that you might... If a melody starts on a high D, that lead-in, you know, where you're playing the first two strings and the first string is open, but the second string, it's open, first fret, second fret. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
And for your listeners, I mean... If you listen to bluegrass at all, you've heard this so many times.
There's only so many openings.
Yeah, and this is one. Of, and I remember when I first learned that, I thought, yeah, that's the stuff.
I guess, I probably learned that lick that Mike's talking about going through Earl's book.
Yeah, you probably. Know, I think Mike actually just learned it from a friend of his in his neighborhood who had started playing banjo at the same
think
time.
He would, but that was my opening was that and the vinyl, the audio sheet that was inside of it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's probably where I learned that. I'm not sure that was so long ago.
So we're progressing through introduction to music and bluegrass and banjo and for we're taking the example of basically a beginner. So
yeah, and but something else that I really like to do, you know, I've written a lot for Banjo Newsletter and for Bluegrass Unlimited and a bunch of other things. Those are the bulk of what I've written about bluegrass. What I really like doing though is getting the chance to try to explain what bluegrass is about to people who don't really know it. It's like Alan Mundy once used the phrase, preaching of bluegrass to the unconverted. It's like, and what, you know, because most people out there, they have, like,
there's Joe Newberry.
Hey, Joe Newberry.
Hey, everyone.
Peace to you, Joe. You know, people, it's kind of a weird thing because most people know that bluegrass exists. They know there's some such a thing as bluegrass. They may have wildly erroneous ideas about what it is and what it's about, but to some extent, this is a sign of our success, that we have made the world aware that we exist. I mean, if you say... No, seriously.
I get what you're saying. You're
right. If you say old-time string band music, you get this blank look. Western swing. You know, if you're east of the Mississippi and you say Western swing, they got no idea what you're talking about. Zydeco, probably there's tons of people who have no idea what
they're right.
So all of these niche musical styles that exist and have these enthusiastic fan bases, and your average person has no idea what they are. But bluegrass, they know, you know, they may
not like it.
They may not like it,
but
or they
recognize it.
Well, they may not even
the
they
term.
May have, they know that there is something called bluegrass. They know they have some idea that it's southern, that it's rural. You know, they might not know who any of the artists are or what musical features are thought by the people who know it to make up, but they know that there is such a thing.
A young beginner student now, mm-hmm. talking to Ira Gitlin, a young beginner student now, they want to learn some music, they have no contact with banjo, and they're one of those few people that can say, yes, I recognize the term of bluegrass, but I've never really heard it. What would you ask them to listen to first? Now, a young student now, what would you introduce them to?
Yeah, I probably would. I might not introduce them to the old masters, because that if you're coming from outside of the bluegrass world and you didn't grow up listening to it, that may take, there's a certain cultural thing. You have to kind of get to know where those guys were coming from.
And
I'm saying this as somebody who grew up in New York City, you know,
right.
So I came to it from outside.
That's what I expected you to say, by the way.
I don't know. If you wanted straight-ahead stuff that really represents bluegrass well but would be accessible to somebody, maybe something like Lonesome River Band, bluegrass album band. I mean, and there's some great...
Well, and there's a lot that fit those. I'm just... you answered the question, is it... And I should have put it this way. Would it be more modern versions of bluegrass, or would it be the original? Because my answer would have been, you can't start them off on Bill Monroe and Ralph Stanley. I mean, it would be unless you really knew what their mind, but...
Right. You know, if it's a kid who grows up in North Carolina and his parents and grandparents have been listening to bluegrass, he's primed for listening to the earlier stuff. But if it's tricky. Some people gravitate towards the more rough-edge stuff, in which case, maybe introduce them to... by a Danny Paisley, if they like, for that balls to the wall kind of approach to playing bluegrass.
Can't say balls on the radio.
Oh, sorry. I shouldn't have said balls.
Staying in now.
Okay.
you meant baseballs, like on a.
Well, actually, I've read some speculation about the etymology of the term, and it may refer to the ball on the end of the I forget what they call it in the cockpit of an airplane. Because the earliest known use of the term is in a novel, and it's describing an air raid in Vietnam. It's actually not a terribly old term.
That makes a whole lot more sense than what I jumped to.
Yeah, well.
It actually makes sense.
Yeah.
Mine doesn't.
At least that's one theory. I don't think anybody has ever determined it. What I was going to say was that my college alumni bulletin used to have a column in every issue called In My Life. This was Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania, and where they would just ask alumni who were doing interesting things off the beaten track, just sort of to write about how they got to where they are. And the guy who was editing it at the time asked me to do it. And I loved that he asked me, because this is my chance to try to explain my world to people who share a lot of my background, people who went to the same college, very kind of intellectually high-powered place, and a lot of them are, doctors and lawyers and professors and stuff. And I can't remember what the word count I was supposed to stay within was, but it was, it was enough to explain some stuff. But it, given, like 2 pages worth or page and a half worth, how can I explain what bluegrass is, how I got into it, how my college, my background at the college, because that, for a specialized readership, figured into it, and just try to give them, and this was the important thing, to try to give them a sense of the flavor of the world, how you can be in a jam session with people who you don't even speak the same language as, and yet you can communicate in real time via the music, things like that, or some of the really, some of the characters you meet who, on paper, they sound so implausible. I mean, you got somebody who got a degree at Harvard, left a job as an investment banker to join a bluegrass band and then founded a successful record company. That's Alison Brown. Or you get,
I'm not going to get all these right, so be careful.
Right, or no, you're not. But that one,
I knew that.
Anybody who follows bluegrass would know her career there. Or, do you know Red Henry?
Yes.
Red and Murphy Henry, they do a lot of instructional materials. And Red is...
He's brilliant beyond compare.
Yeah, he's brilliant. But you wouldn't know that on first meeting, because he's a man of few words, mm-hmm. and he's got this slow southern drawl, and he plays hardcore bluegrass, mm-hmm. and you might think, oh, this guy is just, some uneducated hillbilly.
He's a pilot, a very accomplished astronomer.
He is an amateur translator of ancient Anglo-Saxon literature. Did you know that about him?
I did not know that.
I knew him for years before I found out about that. Yeah. So, there's people who bring all of these different, talents and experiences to it. There have been several bluegrass symposiums, scholarly symposiums, and I was privileged to deliver papers at 2 of them. And the variety of topics, and all connected with bluegrass. There was the first one, the one back in 2005. my own paper was about the evolution of repertoire and practices in jam sessions and how songs and arrangements will differ from the classic versions and why they might. But there was historically oriented papers, of course, you know, about, you know, the history of the bluegrass in the Czech Republic, for instance, which is a hotbed of bluegrass, actually. But there was a theologian who was analyzing the theology of Ralph Stanley's gospel repertoire and trying to see, was there, you know, was there a unified theology behind it, or was he just selecting songs that he thought would appeal to the, you know, the devout people and so on. So I can't remember what conclusion he came to, but it was pretty interesting. There was another one, a guy who discussed the evolution of the hillbilly stereotype in popular culture. It was fascinating. You know, I forget what his background was, but I think he was also an amateur musician as well. A lot of the people, the scholars of that, were.
Well, Ira, we're sitting in upstate New York, what I would tell the rest of the world.
Yeah.
And there is so much bluegrass and string music, we'll say.
Yeah.
And maybe more, maybe if we make a differentiation between string music and bluegrass, which is, to me just means the banjo doesn't have a resonator on it, that might be the easiest
thing. Old-time string bands.
There's so much in this area that it kind of blows your mind to think that they're all within the Northeast sector, I think, has many more new bluegrass, old-time string music players than anywhere else. I mean, they're everywhere.
It might be. I mean, there's a thriving scene for bluegrass and old-time music in Boston, and for a couple of reasons. One is the Boston Bluegrass Union, the local bluegrass association, is very active, more so than a lot of bluegrass associations, and they have events throughout the year, and they have a kids program, and they have regularly occurring jams, so anybody in the Boston area is going to find a very supportive atmosphere. But then they also have the Roots Music Program at the Berklee College of Music, so for more professionally oriented young players, there's some amazing training and opportunities connected with that.
It's a neat and by the way, before I let you go, I know that you have a yearly event that you're involved in.
Oh yeah, I am one of the coordinators of Bluegrass Week at the Augusta Heritage Center in Elkins, West Virginia. The Augusta Heritage Center is it's a organization that's mission is to foster traditional arts, and they're housed at Davis and Elkins College. And in the summer they have these week-long music camps, and for, I think 2013 was my first year as a coordinator for 2014, 15, 16. So this is going to be my sixth year as one of the coordinators of the Bluegrass Week program, and we you know, it's a week of classes and jamming and concerts and square dances.
And instruction of all levels.
Yeah. On most of the instruments, we have beginner, intermediate, and advanced classes.
Yeah.
And then there's a lot of informal learning that happens just from, you know, hanging out with people for the whole week. And you get to, you know, we get some great players, and some of them pretty big names or very big names as our instructors. And you get to hang with them for the...
Which, and there's a little bit that bleeds off from that. There's that contact helps put it in perspective. Like, if nobody knew you and they hung out with you for a while, they would recognize that your approach to music and bluegrass is a pretty sophisticated level. And I think they would come away from hanging around with Ira Gitlin thinking, this music is more than just, than maybe public perception, or this, you mentioned the presentation about the status of the hillbilly character.
Yeah.
It's more than that. Much more than that.
Oh, it's, you know, but the thing is, it can be, but for the individual listener, you can approach it at whatever level. I mean, I'm really into the history of it, as you know.
Yes.
But, you know, a 13-year-old is just getting into the music. Might not care. He just wants to pick.
Yeah.
And you can just approach it at that level. Hang out with your friends and jam.
Yeah.
And if you get interested in why does everybody know this particular song, then you can, you know, look at the history of it and how it's spread and what the different recorded versions are. But you don't have to. You can take it at whatever level you
there are so many
make
tools.
Sense to you.
There are so many tools, physical tools, great teachers like you, but with internet things, you can go back and revisit somebody, save somebody's recording of a 19 something, and you can just go get in this whirlpool of YouTube things and never come back.
Well, you're thinking of what you were before
right.
We started recording.
You're
talking about Joe Mullins going down the YouTube rabbit hole in
yes.
search of old Osborne Brothers
things.
And you know what's another great one? The Johnson Mountain Boys. It wasn't exactly their farewell concert, but it was when they stopped playing full time. It was they made a live album of it,
yeah.
And
Dubhouse?
Yeah, in WETA, the public TV station in the D.C. area, did a TV special of it. And the clips from that a few years ago started showing up on YouTube. I think the guy who actually directed it started uploading them. And this is some of the best, first of all, one of the best bluegrass bands ever, in my opinion.
I agree.
And it's also some of the best filmed bluegrass, because they had a former band member who knew all the arrangements.
And knew where to go.
Directing the
That's
the
a whole other issue.
The three-camera shoot, you know. I was at the concert, this guy was like, he's wandering around on his knees on the stage.
Because he knows where the next point is
coming. Pointing cameras up at,
I've experienced
that. Right up there at the mandolin player.
I actually did that once.
Yeah.
But you have to know what to look for and what to wait for. But that's great. Well, that's
Tons of stuff on YouTube. Yeah. Oh my God, it's amazing.
So, congratulations, being here back at Grey Fox.
It's always great to be back at Grey Fox.
It's a fun place.
Yeah.
People learn so much from people like you, and this is just one small segment of what's available here.
Yeah, there's bluegrass festivals all over the country, and some of the big, a lot of the bigger ones especially will have workshop stages. They'll do, or jamming for beginners or that kind of thing, get people into the whole culture surrounding the music.
Yeah. Thanks, man. Anything else?
No, do I have time to get back to where I have to be working at?
It's 1:30.
Okay, I think I'll run down the hill. Thanks a lot,
you.
Steve.
Thanks, Ira.